You are listening to a sermon by Ruth Enns, recorded on Sunday, August 22, 2010, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
In the introduction to his rhythmic translation of Job in 1889, George H. Gilbert wrote these words: "It has pleased God to send his truth to us by way of human hearts and minds, permitting the lights and shadows of earthly experience to mingle with the radiance from his throne. His truth has not been published on earth except in earthly garb. It is indeed the word of God, but it is nonetheless truly the word of man." When I read through the book of Job in July, it struck me that all the action happens in a few quick verses, and the rest of it is passionate statements of opinion. Because of a casual conversation between Satan and God, disaster is unleashed on Job, and he loses everything in 7 verses. Then Job and his 3 friends get going. His friends insist that because he is being punished, he must be evil in some way, while Job goes on about how innocent he is. The whippersnapper Elihu comes in with his take on the situation, telling the 4 men they've got it all wrong. Finally, God steps forward to clear up the mess with his own gloriously poetic rant, and all is set right in a short concluding passage. It was my impression at first that I couldn't remember even hearing the name Elihu until I got this assignment. But then I realized that the American detective novelist Dashiell Hammett named one of his characters Elihu Wilson, a well-spoken, silver-haired businessman with an aura of respectability, but corrupt and sinful to the core. The Elihu of the Job story is almost the opposite sort of character, a spirited young man who listens to his elders, but eventually feels called to blurt out his viewpoints on the situation of Job and his friends. Late in his life, the poet William Blake created a series of illustrations of the book of Job. I brought it with me. You can see them later if you want. His image of the entrance of Elihu has Job's 3 friends grouped in a skeptical lump on one side, Job's wife, a headless huddle of sorrow, on the other. She's all covered up. Job looks like he's not feeling well, but he still looks powerful, and he is paying attention. The beardless youth Elihu is all in motion, pacing, arms flung aloft, eyes ablaze, mouth at work. Elihu has received some bad press over the years from commentators. Accusations are, this section is long, boring, poorly integrated into the rest of the story, and probably not part of the original. It is the longest monologue in the book, and it does have some repetitions. Elihu seems to think it necessary to tell Job and his friends over and over that, although he is young, maybe he has some things figured out that they don't. And some of his arguments do repeat what the others have said. Scholars think this whole section, chapters 32 to 37, may have been added at some later stage, because Elihu is not mentioned in any of the preceding chapters, nor is he referred to in the final chapters. He steps in to say his piece and then is gone. Pope Gregory the Great, around 600, said the Elihu chapters had little value. Peter Maxwell Davies eliminated him entirely from his oratorial Job of 1997. The style and vocabulary of this section of Job are quite distinct from the rest of the book, more complicated, and using Hebrew words that are not now well understood. Furthermore, it seems clear that the manuscript of the middle section of Job was physically damaged in the early years of its transmission, causing some sections in the dialogues that Andre talked about last week to go missing, and this Elihu section to be subject to some creative scribal guesswork. These two factors explain why there are so many translations of Job which differ quite significantly from one another. The theory of this being a subsequent addendum suggests someone felt the need to go beyond the arguments of Job and the three friends. Perhaps a later writer chose a young character to metaphorically represent a later opinion. One idea I liked, written by Jewish Job scholar Robert Gordas, says that while the other sections could have been written while the author was young, the Elihu section might have been added later by the original author. This would explain both similarities and changes in style. His later thoughts were put in the voice of a young man, but expressed in more complex language. The name Elihu is a variant of Elijah, meaning Yah is my God, a name of significance. He is the only character in the story to be identified by family background. He is son of Barachel the Buzite from the family of Ram, which the scholars say links him to the family of Abraham and makes him an ancestor of David. Anyone who's been to a family gathering knows how that talk goes. Unlike Job, who is non-Hebrew, a kind of upper-class existential everyman, Elihu has significant connections with the best Hebrew circles. The names also have other symbolic meaning. Barachel means blessed by God, Ram meaning exalted, and Buz meaning scorn. His name suggests he is scornful of the elders and conscious of his high role as a defender of God. To explain the sudden presence of Elihu, the writer of Job says that Elihu has been there listening to the four friends from the beginning of the conversation and has become angry and frustrated with them. As the friends reach an impasse, he just can't stand it anymore, and he jumps into the fray, of course, in the form of poetry. I particularly like the simile that he feels he is ready to burst like a new wineskin. It seems to me that Elihu does give a different perspective on the situation than Job or any of his three friends. The friends have been raised to believe that punishment from God means guilt for something, a common assumption in those days. Old Testament prophets were always going on about God bringing down punishment for bad behavior. Meanwhile, Job is stuck on insisting that he has obeyed all the rules for righteous living, and he could prove it to God if God would take the time to come down and hold court. Chapter 31 is a statement of Job's moral code, showing how high a standard of behavior he has held himself to. Job expresses various shades of anger, despair, and grief over his condition. He never gives up on God, but longs for more direct contact with him. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about those sections that are in your bulletin. In chapter 33, 8 to 13, Elihu brings up some of Job's arguments. Job says he is sinless, free of fault, yet God punishes him and does not respond to him. Elihu expresses dismay that Job says God has ignored his suffering by refusing to answer him. God can speak in ways man doesn't always recognize. Elihu gives examples. Starting in verse 15, He says God can speak in dreams and visions, working to correct evil doing and pride, ultimately saving a person from damning himself. When Job angrily calls on God to meet him in court, does he approach the arrogance that all too commonly flows from the consciousness of virtue? There is a Jewish saying, far better a sinner who knows he is a sinner than a saint who knows he is a saint. In verses 19 to 30, Elihu further explains how God can use suffering to teach men to appreciate the wisdom and mercy of God. There is a long description of terrible illness, followed by recovery and testimony. Suffering can protect against greater sin and teach someone to trust God in adversity. Suffering can make you a better person. It can have educational value. I try to teach my students this quite regularly. Suffering can be communication from God and need not always be in punishment. This is a viewpoint that mediates between Job's position that God doesn't communicate and the three friends who say suffering is always God's punishment for sin. This is the most important new argument Elihu adds to the dialogue. Christians take particular interest in the description of verses 23 to 25, in which an angel advocate or spokesman intercedes for the sufferer, vouching for God before God for the man's uprightness. This is one of those sections that is translated in quite diverse ways. But in all the translations, there is a foreshadowing of the role of Jesus as intercessor between God and man. For Christians, Elihu affirms the need for the redemption brought by Jesus Christ. In the next chapters, Elihu addresses Job's complaint that God is not just. God is creator of all and has no need to play favorites. He can destroy kings and princes in a moment, but sometimes he may delay doing so as punishment or in hopes of repentance. Why should God be governed by Job's wishes? God is beyond man's understanding. In chapter 35:16, Elihu says, Job keeps mouthing empty talk and multiplies words without knowledge. Some commentators charge that Elihu shows he has the same purpose as the friends. He judges Job superficially from Job's words of frustration, wanting to bring him to confession of sins and acknowledgement of the superiority of God. But perhaps, as Sven mentioned last week, he is suggesting that Job broaden his viewpoint. Andre raised the possibility that Job has been stuck in a relationship with God in which Job thinks that if he obeys the rules, he should be blessed by God. And if it doesn't work that way, he deserves an explanation. The next time Job speaks, which is in Carl's section for next week, he has changed his stance toward God. As a result of his suffering and his encounter with God, he achieves a more cosmic perspective, as well as a deeper appreciation of the mysterious nature of God. The final speech of Elihu is called A Hymn to God's Wisdom and Omnipotence in the Jerusalem Bible. Elihu notices the weather changing, a storm gathering in the sky. This inspires him to break into a paean of praise to the greatness of the Creator, whose mysterious ways are manifest in nature. Clouds and rain, thunder and lightning, snow and heat, the golden splendor of the sun are evidence of the power and justice of God. Although we do not always understand or appreciate the weather, our planet is a wonderful place. This seems to me to be a great preparation for the voice of God speaking from a whirlwind in the next chapter. I cast my vote with the pro-Elihu group. Although he is a bit wordy, he adds something important to the discussion. Rather than have God speak directly after the last words of Job, Elihu prepares us by arguing for God's power, redemptive salvation, and absolute rightness in all his conduct. God is mighty yet just and quick to warn and to forgive. I like the interjection of a youthful character in this discussion among men. Elihu's emphasis on suffering as a moral discipline in the life of man is an important contribution. In his rapturous tribute to the weather, Elihu also helps us transition to the mighty final scene in which God himself makes an appearance. In conclusion, I would like us to read Elihu's weather poem together. In this time of climate change and weather disasters, it has a special poignancy. I'd like to split us in half, maybe right there. So these guys are going to read the bold print, and these guys will read the italic print. Would you like to bring it? So a big deal about Job is the language, right? It's the poetry. So just let the words roll over your tongue as we run through this. So starting with the italics. Are you going to hear the italics, right?
No.
Oh, cool. Okay. Starting with the italics. Here we go.
See, God is exalted in his power.
Who is
a teacher like him? Who has prescribed for him his way? Or who can say, you have done wrong? Remember to extol his work, of which mortals have sung. All people have looked on it. Everyone watches it from far away. Surely God is great, and we do not know him. The number of his years is unsearchable. For he draws up the drops of water, he distills his mist in rain, which the skies pour down and drop upon mortals abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunderings of his pavilion? See, he scatters his lightning around him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he governs peoples. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. His crashing tells about him. He is jealous with anger against iniquity. At this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Listen to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole of heaven he lets it loose and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. For to the snow he says, fall on the earth, and the shower of rain, his heavy shower of rain, serves as a sign on everyone's hand, so that all whom he has made may know it. Then the animals go into their lairs and remain in their dens. From its chamber comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen fast. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn round and round by his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world. Whether for correction or for his land for love he causes it to happen. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of the one whose knowledge is perfect? You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind. Can you, like him, spread out the skies, unyielding as a cast mirror? Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. Should it be told that I want to speak? Did anyone ever wish to be swallowed up?
Now no one can look on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them.
Out of the north comes golden splendor. Around God is awesome majesty.
The Almighty, we cannot find him.
He is great in power and justice, and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore mortals fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit.
Thank you.